Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Education Committee to order. It is Monday, March 23rd, 2026, and the time is 8:04 a.m. Present are Representative Elam, Representative Dibert, Representative Schwanke, Representative Eichheit, Representative Underwood, Co-Chair Story, and myself, Co-Chair Himshute. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to silence your cell phones. We're in the Betty Davis Committee Room 106 in the State Capitol Building here in Juneau, Alaska. The documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members, are available on the table outside the door, and are on basis. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Kale Brown, and our moderator from the Juneau LIO, Chloe Miller, and our committee aides, Ella Lubin and Tammy Smith, for their excellent work this morning. Today's agenda, we have several items. We're going to keep it moving this morning. We're going to start with a short presentation as part of our Celebrating Excellence series. This presentation is from Representative Underwood's Mat-Su School District. And then after that, we will have House Bill 380, House Bill 374, and Senate Bill 20. I'd like to welcome Representative Underwood to introduce yourself on the record and I guess get us going on this presentation. And we will be joined online by Colony High School music teachers Dr. Jamin Burton and Kelly Rentz. Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Himshute, and I will do a brief introduction on these two. We had so many amazing things to pick from the Mat-Su, and I'm excited to have Dr. Jamin Burton and Kelly Rentz here this morning. A little bit about each of them. Dr. Jamin Burton is the band and orchestra director at Colony High School, and he's the 2026 Alaska Music Educators Association Teacher of the Year. He is recognized across Alaska for his leadership in music education and his impact on students at Colony High School and throughout the Mat-Su Borough School District. I will say from personal experience, my son was a huge sports player at Colony for football and basketball, and if you have never been to a Colony football game, you are missing out. But Dr. Burton and his orchestra and the band is very, very, very entertaining. So I do miss those days. And then we have Miss Kelly Rentz. She's the choir and drama director at Colony High School. She is the 2025 Alaska Teacher of the Year. With decades of experience in music education, she is known for building a strong, inclusive program for her students' outstanding achievements in performance and statewide honors. And together, Dr. Burton and Miss Rentz collaborate on a number of student opportunities, including their recent production of Newsies and co-hosting the Mat-Su District Honor Festival, providing students with high-level performance experiences in the fine arts. And I'm not sure who's kind of going to lead the charge, but I'm going to pass it over to them, too, and I believe they have a short slideshow for
you
guys.
Yeah, if you could each put your names on record and then begin your presentation, we're really excited to see this. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Kelly Rentz.
And I'm Jamin Burton.
And we thought we would present a little slideshow for you. I know it's longer than you're used to, so you can move quickly through the slides. Just kind of a year in the life at Colony High Music. We are going to start with last year's production of Hadestown. This is a joint production by music, by both departments. I also do drama, so drama, choir, and band. And we try to get as many kids on stage as possible. We work from November to about February to present the show to the community and try to get as many student-led things as we can, the lights, the sound. It's a student-run production once they learn how to do that. So these are all just pictures from that. And you can move through slides 2 through 4 if you want pretty quickly.
Then after you get through the Hadestown slides, slides 4 and 5 are of the music department in Ireland. Last spring, we had the opportunity to perform in the St. Patrick's Dublin Parade, and we took marching band, orchestra, and choir, and we performed all over Ireland. We performed in Cove at their beautiful cathedral and then in Limerick. I think the highlight of the trip, other than the great culture, food, and weather, was in Limerick. We had the performance at a cathedral, and the audience interrupted mid-set for the choir to give them a standing ovation because they were just that well-prepared and they were that role receptive. And it was just a fantastic performance opportunity for all of these students. And then after the Ireland trip, we have some pictures of our marching band. Known as the Northern Sound, the marching band has performed at events all across the country and the world. We've been in Normandy, France, and Ireland, and St. Patrick's Parade, the Macy's Parade, the Rose Parade. Started the marching band 22 years ago now, and we had about 106 people in it when we did the Macy's Parade, Since COVID, it's been a little bit smaller, but we enjoy putting the Friday night lights in the football games at Colony High School for sure.
The next slide are just some choir opportunities we've had recently. Last year, we had a group that were the state champs performing a song from Newsies before we even really decided we were doing Newsies. And then this August at the Alaska State Fair, they were delighted to get to sing backup for Foreigner on one of their songs. So that was a really fun opportunity for them. And for me, this 80s chick right here was in heaven.
I was going to say, I went to a Foreigner concert in the 80s. Hello.
And okay. I say that I was actually there at that performance. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you. The next slide is from the drama department. We had a senior this year, George Burlingame, who actually lost his mother. His mother was our choreographer for our shows and died suddenly. An amazing man. I just wanted to highlight what he did this year in our drama. He wrote our fall show and directed it, and he's moving on in college to direct film. So it's really, you know, we try to pull the kids in and give them leadership opportunities to do things like that. And he just really shone this year. So I wanted to highlight him.
Another thing that we do every year and take a lot of pride in is just having a lot of participation in the music festivals around the state from the ASA side of things. So there's a picture there that has our contingent at the Allstate Festival. We had several first chair medallion recipients in the choir. Represented an orchestra, band, and choir, and all the kids are, they represent Colony High School in Alaska really well, and they're top-notch students, and they do these great performances, and every November, that All-State thing is one of the highlights of the year for us.
And then in slides 13 and 14 are just some of the concerts we do. We do a fall concert separately. We do a midwinter concert separately. And then at Christmas, we do a joint concert with all of the music programs, the choir, the band, the orchestra, jazz band, percussion, and kind of invite the community, our alumni, to join us. Dr. Burton wrote O Holy Night, an orchestra arrangement for the choir song, and we invite all of our alumni to come and sing at the end of the concert for us. It also happens to be on the day of our school-wide pep rally that's themed around something. This year was Elf, and it's a big time. It's a great concert, and then we usually end the year with separate concerts as well.
And then after that, it's been a full year since we started now, so we ended just our last couple weekends we did was our Newsies production. So we started with our musical from last year and ending with our musical from this year. Newsies was a spectacular show, dancing, flipping, great music, great acting, beautiful set. Kelly already mentioned that our George's mother passed away and she was our choreographer. And so we had two students actually finish the choreography and teach the choreography to the students here. So it was really a student-driven run show. And they sold out the Glenn Massey Theater and just had a spectacular time. And one of the things that I loved about this show is that we had the opportunity to have a couple cameos from some of our vice principals. And so they got to play the Teddy Roosevelt character and be the only adults on stage. And the audience loved that, and the students loved working with them. And it was great to have them there because they got to see the process from start to finish and understand how much work these students put into it and how good it is for them and what skills they're developing, not just performing a musical, but gaining leadership and confidence and creativity in all the areas that are going to be helpful for them moving on.
The very last slide, give me through the Newsies, was just last weekend, the weekend of spring break. My choir goes up and sings at the start of the Iditarod, which is probably the most Alaskan thing we do. They sing the Alaska State song and the national anthem. So that was really fun. And then after, even just this past Friday night, there was an opportunity where the Palmer Arts Council brought in a group called Ball in the House, and they came and did a workshop with my students, and then we had a concert that night and got to sing with one of them. But we try to say yes to everything. We're often tired, but fun in a fun way. And really the object is to get these kids out in the community and to get them some real life skills. I know a lot of the kids that worked on Newsies And then worked in Hadestown. We have a senior that graduated last year who ran our sound system for us this year. So we try to give them real life experiences where they can go out then and be involved in the community and just be ready for life for whatever happens. Music is something that you can do for the rest of your life. Yesterday we had probably 20 people participate in a performance at the Glen Massey Lamb of God. And, you know, we know that they're not all going to go on to be professional musicians, but they can do their real life job and still support their community arts in the process. So,
and part of that, too, is we are really big proponents of supporting our school community. So we perform in assemblies and we perform for the student body and we go to the football and basketball and hockey game, and we try to get music in front of as many people as we can. And it helps, I think, the students feel a sense of community with each other, and it pulls the other adults and community members that aren't in the school on a daily basis into what's going on, and kind of highlights some of the positive things happening in schools. I wanted to just end with a couple of like highlight quotes about the importance of music in education and fine arts opportunities, and I'm pulling these from the National Association for Music Education's website. Research shows that at least some musical education has a positive impact on social and cognitive development of children, and these effects are long-lasting: better hearing, better motor skills, improved memory, better verbal and literacy skills. And then a second quote that I have says, musician is constantly adjusting decisions, tempo, tone, style, rhythm, phrasing, feeling, and training the brain to become incredibly good at organizing and conducting numerous activities at once. Dedicated practice of this orchestration can have a great payoff for lifelong attention skills, intelligence, and an ability for self-knowledge and expression. And we just wanted to conclude by saying thank you for having us this morning. That's a 10-minute review of a year in the life of Colony High School Music.
And if you have any questions, we'll take those.
I think we could take a minute for some very quick questions, Representative Dibert. And I just want to say tired but inspired is maybe going to be your motto. Representative Dibert,
seriously, thank you.
I like that. I like that.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Dr. Burton and Ms. Renz. Thank you so much for your presentation and your work with students in Alaska. I hope to one day get to see your students perform. I myself took orchestra from fourth grade through 12th grade, and I was in choir from elementary school to middle school and loved. I think my last performance was The Rainbow Connection by the Muppets, which was really amazing. I had such a fun time in middle school singing that that musical. Made an impact on my life. And so my question for you is, does students who take choir, band, orchestra in elementary and middle school make a difference when you see them get to high school? Do you see a big difference between
100%.
Students?
Okay. Yes.
Can you speak on that?
Yeah. I can speak to choir and then I'll turn it over to Jamin, but I know when kids don't have the option of music in elementary school, they tend to not want to choose it in, or they haven't been exposed to it in middle school. We can't have these top level performers that don't start somewhere smaller. You know what I mean? If they come in ninth grade and they're just learning how to read music, or 10th grade, you're not going to then have that level of excellence that that you kind of aim for.
And I would say, too, in addition to just starting them young and being able to have high performances, I think that music is just good for every single person. One of my favorite quotes I like to tell people is that the highest percentage of undergraduate acceptance into medical school is music. So if you do a music major and then apply to medical school, that's the highest rate of acceptance into medical school. And I think that it's because it develops your brain in a way that builds connections across curriculum, and it makes you a well-rounded, able to think and rationalize and understand things. And we've seen so many kids that come in and just are kind of in a shell. And by the time they graduate from high school 4 years later, you just see so much growth, tremendous ability to perform and to be in front of people. And the leadership growth and how it connects to other things is important.
Well, one of the examples is at the end of the year, some of the AP higher honors courses our principal was putting locker signs on people that had gotten really high scores on some of their tests. And as I was going down the hallway, I said, "Did you notice something?" And she said, "Yes, every single one of these students is in the music program." So I think that kind of speaks highly too of what being in music has done for these students.
Fantastic. Any other questions before we move on with our agenda? Representative Eichheit?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. Just a quick question. How many years have each of you been working in education, please?
I've been teaching since 1989.
And I started in 2004.
Thank you.
He's a lot younger than I am.
Representative Story. Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. Through the chair, thank you for your presentation and congratulations on building such a wonderful, fine program. I have to tell you, I was reminiscing and could name all my band and choir teachers, and I'm the shout out to our music program, and the capital city here is wonderful too. My question has been your feeder programs. When do you start offering music in your community, and has that is there a firm commitment on the school board to that, or has that been slated for possible cuts with the budget? So if you could start with what your program currently is, starting in elementary school. Thank you.
The kind of a little bit weird as a teacher talking about politics at work. It's hard to answer that question because we don't know. When I started teaching in the district 20 years ago, every elementary school had music, and that is not true anymore. I'm sure you've all seen the news that schools are closing across the state, and the MASU just voted to close 3 schools. Along with those budget cuts, they are talking about removing specialists from schools. So we have some schools where they start music in kindergarten, and we have some schools where they teach it later, like 4th or 5th grade. We have some schools where they start band in 5th grade, and some schools where they start in 6th or 7th grade. And so we're getting kids with a wide range of ability coming in, and it really is a trick to try to figure out where they are and how to make cohesive groups and help them all progress with that. It's a challenge.
Thank you for that. And I had one last quick question. That set for Newsies, who constructed that?
So Jack Foster, who is a former teacher for the MATSU, we had he didn't design it, he built it. And then we had a former member of the Glenn Massey Theater, who no longer, he's out of state, but he designed that. So, but with the help of parents and kids, we had some work days where the kids would come in and he would teach them. So it's kind of a learning process the whole way, putting kids behind and, giving them the power to learn how to use drills and how to put sets together and how to build things. So definitely a group effort, and Jack Foster led the way on that.
Amazing that the retired stay involved as well. So it really is a work of the heart. Thank you so much for being with us this morning and helping us celebrate what you do and the great things that are happening in your programs. Really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having us. And we're going to go off because we have kids coming in now.
Okay, perfect timing. Okay, we're going to move on in our agenda as well. I want to recognize Representative Bynum joined us at 8:07, so he got to see what's happening up in the MATSU as well, which is great. And next on our agenda is House Bill 380 by the House Education Committee, entitled An Act Relating to Funding for Residential Schools. This is the first hearing of this bill and its first committee of referral, and I'm passing the gavel over to Co-Chair Story, and I'm going to wander out to that table, and I don't think we'll even take it at ease because there's no presentation to set up. So,
thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. Welcome to the dais. Can you please introduce yourself for the record and any staff with you today?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Rebecca Hemshute. I am co-chair of education. I also represent House District 2 here in Southeast Alaska. And with me?
For the record, Edward Richards, staff to Representative Hemshute.
We also call him EJ. I think I can just tell you briefly what we're trying to do with this bill, and then EJ will go through the sectional analysis, and we have a couple of folks for invited testimony. So this With the Education Funding Task Force, we were able to visit the Nenana Student Living Center, and they showed us what they're doing out there. Great program. And then they said, and we haven't had an increase since 2015. So think about how costs have gone up in your old household budget from 2015 until now. So they also added it's going to be really hard to continue operating if something isn't done to adjust the budget for the living side. So this is not the base student allocation. This is the living side of what they do. There are 9 approved residential school programs across the state. This bill makes an adjustment, so they're each paid by region monthly for the students in their care. This bill makes an inflationary adjustment to that monthly amount based between 2015 and now. So I guess I'm going to stop there, assuming you guys know a lot about these schools. If you don't, we have a little more information, and I'd like to turn it over to EJ to go through the sectional analysis. It's pretty quick.
Again, for the record, EJ Richards, Staff Representative Hemshue, and through the co-chair to the rest of the committee, I'll be presenting the sectional analysis for House Bill 380. Version A, sorry. Section 1 amends AS 1416-200B by increasing the funding for the per-pupil monthly stipend by the following for each respective region. A $319 increase for a total of $1,549 for Region 1. A $312 increase for a total of $1,512 for Region 2. A $377 increase for a total of $1,829 for Region 3. A $392 increase for a total of $1,901 for Region 4. A $461 increase for a total of $2,237 for Region 5. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
And that it's a pretty straightforward bill. So through co-chair Story to the committee, we're available for questions or to go to invited testimony.
I think, do we have any questions at this time? Okay, we will hear invited testimony then right now. We'll proceed to that. And I see that we would like to invite Conrad Woodhead to unmute, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning to each member of the House Education Committee, and thank you for looking at residential funding and allowing me to speak to the issue. For the record, my name is Conrad Woodhead, and I serve as the Career and Technical Education and Kuzovac Career Academy Director for the Lower Yukon School District. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska Residential Schools Coalition, representing districts across the state that operate residential programs and serve students from some of the most remote communities in Alaska. First, thank you for bringing House Bill 380 forward. The coalition appreciates the committee recognizing that residential programs play a critical role in expanding access to career and technical education, workforce pathways, dual credit opportunities, and industry-aligned instruction, opportunities that districts like the Lower Yukon School District cannot provide at scale without residential access. Year-round boarding schools and variable-term workforce programs like Kuzovac Career Academy integrate K-12, university, industry, and nonprofit partnerships to deliver programming that is more resource-intensive and, in many cases, simply does not exist in students' home communities. I'm encouraged that workforce development is at the forefront of conversations right now. It's a priority in just about every room I've been in this year. But the reality is the residential funding structure has not kept pace with that priority, and the current model is not sustainable over time. As mentioned, these figures are not estimates. They're based on audited FY24 data compiled by Mr. Jerry Covey across our coalition districts. That analysis shows it costs approximately $25,700 per student to provide room and board, while the state stipend is about $12,900, covering only about half of the actual cost. And importantly, those stipend levels have not been updated since FY15. With the loss of one-time appropriations in FY26, residential programs are now operating with less funding than they had in recent years. In the Lower Yukon School District, for example, the funding we receive to house students in residential programs covers, on average, just about 20% of the actual operating costs of our program. Many of these programs are doing their part, but we cannot do it alone. KCA, for example, has helped close that gap through opportunities with the Federal Office of Indian Ed, the discretionary grants made possible by our partnerships with our tribal communities. But those funds are limited, competitive, not a stable long-term solution, and they still leave a significant gap. House Bill 380 is a step in the right direction, and we appreciate the committee's leadership. However, it does not yet fully address the scale of the funding gap needed to stabilize residential programs. So we would encourage continued consideration of alignment with Senate Bill 257, which more fully reflects actual operating costs and ensures funding keeps pace moving forward. Again, I appreciate the committee for your work and taking testimony on this important bill. Adjusting and taking a look at this will help programs like our continue to do the important work of helping our students become Alaska's next workforce. So thank you.
Do I have any questions for for Mr. Woodhead? And thank you for your presentation. Any questions? I have a question. I don't know, Mr. Woodhead, if you can help me understand this, but when I look at the different regions and there's a different amount for each residential school, was that, if you could help me understand the history behind that, does it have to do with geographic cost factors in the region, different years that they went into effect? Any history you have on that would be helpful for me.
Sure. Those amounts are based off of regional locations of these programs. So, for example, Kuzovac Career Academy operates in Anchorage. And so we have a lot of resources in Anchorage, whereas NACTEC operates in Nome. And the shipping costs and personnel costs are different. So, and I'm sure Mr. Manning would agree that those regional adjustments are important and a reflection of the true costs of programs like ours.
Thank you for that information. Seeing no further questions, we will now move on to Patrick Manning. He is the superintendent with Nanani City School Districts. Welcome. Mr. Manning, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hemshute, Co-Chair Story, and members of the House Education Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Patrick Manning. I'm the superintendent of Nanana City School District, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Residential Schools Coalition. I want to begin by thanking you for bringing forward House Bill 380. We truly appreciate the committee's recognition that residential school funding has not kept pace with inflation and that this issue deserves attention. Alaska's residential schools are playing an important role in preparing students for the state's workforce. Through career and technical education, dual credit opportunities, and hands-on training that connects directly to employment opportunities here in Alaska. For many students in rural communities, these programs provide access to opportunities that would otherwise be out of reach. At the same time, we'd like to share some context around the current funding structure. Residential school stipend funding has remained essentially unchanged since FY15, even as costs have steadily increased. Based on audited expenditures from Alaska's seven residential schools 2 years ago, the average cost to house and feed a student was approximately $25,700 compared to a state stipend of about $12,900. This creates a significant gap that the districts have been working hard to absorb in order to continue offering these programs. We are very grateful for the one-time funding provided in recent years, which has helped sustain programs. With those funds no longer in place, however, we are now seeing increased pressure on districts as funding is returned to earlier statutory levels. Looking ahead, our shared goal is to ensure that these programs remain stable and continue to serve students across Alaska. House Bill 380 is a meaningful step in that direction, and we appreciate the effort to move this conversation forward. We would also respectfully encourage consideration of how this bill might be strengthened to more fully address both current needs and long-term sustainability. In that context, Senate Bill 257 offers a helpful framework. It more closely aligns stipend funding with actual costs, provides a mechanism to keep funding aligned with future BSA adjustments, and helps address the immediate funding gap beginning in FY26. We believe aligning House Bill 380 more closely with the approach outlined in Senate Bill 257 could provide a more comprehensive and lasting solution. Our intent is not to expand programs, but to ensure that the strong programs already in place can continue to serve students and support Alaska's workforce needs. We appreciate the committee's attention to this issue and your continued support of Alaska's students and communities. Thank you again for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you for that, Mr. Manning. I see we have a question from Rep. Dybert.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to either Superintendent Manning or Mr. Woodhead. I appreciate Representative Story's question on just the numbers for each region. But I want to hone in on Region 5, which is the highest dollar amount. And just, I'm assuming some of that is due to, like, the high cost of energy and heating our homes. Also, maybe transportation of materials. And I know that Fairbanks is probably the hub for resources and materials. Not sure, but I just wanted to highlight that high cost for Region 5, if you want to expand on that or not. Thank you.
Any question? Any comments on that from Mr. Woodhead or Superintendent Manning?
Through the co-chair, I can comment on that.
Put your name on the record again. We have two of the males testifying, and it's helpful for the recording, Secretary. Thank you.
Sure. This is Superintendent Manning, Nenana City School District. Many of the things that you mentioned are the reason for that. They're the travel costs for sending students to these facilities, as well as just the supplies that need to be shipped in to cover their boarding and taking care of them while they're in these facilities. All of that has gone up drastically in the last few years. It's very expensive to get these resources out to these sites, and everything is exponentially more expensive in those that are further from the hubs.
Follow-up, Ms. Rep. Dybert.
Thank you, Superintendent Manning. And can you share with the committee just an overview of Region 5, like that includes Fairbanks, Nenana, to maybe Galena? I'm not sure. Does maybe Mr. Woodhead or Superintendent Manning?
Yes, I don't know who would like to answer that question, but please introduce yourself again for the record.
Yeah, Conrad Woodhead, Roosevelt Career Academy, Lower Yukon School District. Just to speak to that question, that's the idea here is that the subregions of Alaska have different costs associated with putting on programs like ours. And so I think that these bills do and fit into past practice, looking at different regions, looking at the actual cost associated with those regions, and then trying to fund appropriately, because there is argument that folks that are closer to the hubs have less expense versus folks that are more remote. I have you know, myself tried to make the argument that because we're serving Western Alaska, perhaps we should be considered as part of the Western Alaska. And then, but since we're operating actually in Anchorage and not in one of our remote regions, the adjustment in cost reflects that. So that's as much as I can say to that and the past history for that. But hopefully that provides some context.
Rep. Dybert, is that satisfactory? I see that the sponsor, co-chair Hemshute, has a comment or question, and then I have Rep. Schwanke and Rep. Eyscheid in the queue.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Sorry, I thought it might be helpful if I just read off the names of the schools so that you can get a sense of where they are, because you'll recognize them from your home district. So Region 1 doesn't have any of these residential schools, and notably we do have Mount Edgecombe, but that is not included in this. Mount Edgecombe is funded separately as a division of the Department of Education. So in Region 2, we have Voyage to Excellence and Kusilvak Career Academy. Region 3, and that serves those two facilities serve a total of 74 if they're fully enrolled. And then Region 3 has 100 total students at Nenana Living Center. Region 4 has 75 total students if fully enrolled at Kuskokwim Learning Academy and Ready Academy. And then Region 5 could have up to 296 total students at the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center, Galena Interior Learning Academy, Residential Living Center at Gavik, and Star of the Northwest. So I hope that adds some context to which facilities we're talking about.
Thank you for that. Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, the co-chair. Thank you both, Mr. Woodhead and Superintendent Manning, for being here and presenting today. I would like both of you to offer just a highlight of some of the opportunities that some of our Alaskan students receive at your residential schools or academies that they cannot get in their communities. And I understand a lot of kids come to these residential and academy programs for a lot of different reasons, but I do know that several come from very small communities and villages that literally do not have high school opportunities. So I'd love to hear some of that from you.
Thank you for that question, Rep. Schwanke. If you could start, Mr. Woodhead, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Mr. Woodhead, KCA, Lower Yukon School District. I can talk about this stuff all day. I won't today. I'm really excited about the metrics that programming like ours are starting to receive. We serve and we have three different variable term intensives that we provide. We provide weekly intensives with some key partnerships. We provide quarterly intensives, and we provide semesterly intensives. For the quarterly and semesterly intensives, we are serving Lower Yukon School District students from our 10 village sites along the Lower Yukon Delta and the coast down to Scammon Bay and Hooper Bay. We are finding that roughly 50% of our graduating classes are taking advantage of one or more session of KCA throughout their high school career. And for those 50% of graduates that take advantage of our programming, we're producing 70% of our district's valedictorians and salutatorians out of that. And for the last 3 years, if you've come to KCA one or more sessions, you had a 0% dropout rate for that 50% of the graduating classes that are taking advantage of our programming. We steer students to career and technical education opportunities. You know, one of the highlights of our model is that we're bringing students a quarter at a time, so roughly 8 to 9 weeks at a time. We're finding that that is enough time to make really tangible changes in students. And they come back to their villages more prepared, talking about their future. And then we help them really get ready for the day after high school and what that could look like for students. And then we also are the dual credit conduit for our district. So if students are accessing dual college credit through opportunities like middle college, Alaska Middle College School, and then ANSEP Acceleration. We are the housing conduit for students from our region to participate in ANSEP Acceleration. And then we have a great partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks's Teaching Through Technology, T3, Alaska program, which provides a lot of different dual credit opportunities and career pathway opportunities for students.
bringing our students to those resources has been really advantageous to us, but it's come at a cost. We knew back in 2019 to build a regional hub, it was going to cost about $95 million. We used capital improvement monies to buy about a half-star hotel here in Anchorage and then renovate it and use that as the conduit to access just these really amazing programs that our students now have access to.
Mr. Woodhead, thank you for that. Could you please clarify some of those programs?
So we have nonprofit partners like Alaska Resource Education and Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Those folks come in and teach our students along with one of our teacher record folks. We're not using OASD teacher to teach science. We're using partners to teach science. So that's a great example. We go over to King Tech High School and access up to 17 different career pathways over there. So students get to do that. The makeup of that partnership is that Lower Yukon School District, with their residential and Perkins funding, buys the tuition to allows access for our students to go over to King Tech High School. And then Anchorage School District then opens the door to students from their eight comprehensive high schools to come join our students. And I think that that's really where the magic is. Our students, you know, they're a pretty big fish in a pretty small pond. And when they come to Anchorage, we kind of flip that and they have to work with next to students from one of the most diverse school districts in the nation and get to learn how to work with others with different backgrounds and while they're preparing for what they want to do after high school. And I want to be clear too, you know, we want our students to be successful no matter where they end up. So we're not encouraging students to go one way or another. What we encourage students to do is find their own pathway and we can help them get there. So if that means sustaining themselves in a, you know, some sort of hitch work in the industry or seasonal work that allows them to go home and be the best subsistence hunter they can be, then we want to support that. If they want to be somewhere else or go see the world, we also want to support that. So we blitz our kids with options and then support them in the pathways that they want to see themselves in. And then we're highly encouraging. We provide all the wraparound services to help our students because we believe here at KCA that we really can't prepare for the day after high school until we take care of the needs of the day. So we've added a lot of resources to help support our students in that way.
Thank you, Mr. Woodhead. Before we go on to Superintendent Manning, you said you had 50% of the students chose to attend a variable term. Is that because that's what the funding is limited to, or is it because some students just aren't ready to go away from home and go to a variable school?
Sure. I think it's a little bit of both. And I think that why our model seems to work so well for our student population is because year-round boarding schools for our students, you know, going to a more urban setting or a bigger place, it's kind of a scary thing. And that's a year-long commitment. So the light at the end of that year-long tunnel for some of our students, and we do, we lose over, you know, about 100, 120 students a year-round boarding school options every year. But we're finding that for some of those students, they're picking KCA because they can come back quarter after quarter here. For about a dozen to 18 students, they're choosing us as their year-round boarding school option. But for others, they get to pick and choose when they want to be here. So if they want to be home for moose or goose season, they can do that and still access career and technical education. If they want to go home for basketball season or mixed six volleyball season, they can do that. They can pick and choose. So it's really nice because it just provides another option for students without having to give up. You know, if I'm an elementary kid or a middle school kid and all I have dreamt about is playing basketball in Scammon Bay for Harley Sundown my whole life, then I might not want to go to a year boarding school option. So it's really nice to have those options for students. Kids get to pick and choose now. It doesn't feel so high stakes for them, and it's safe. We are a bubble of the culture right here in Anchorage. We're 60% OISD product working in our staff. We are inviting, and what better way than to help our young students understand what it takes to be from the region, to make it in Anchorage, or to go back home and try to make it on their own. It's just they're great examples for our students. So,
thank you for that, Mr. Woodhead. We will now go to Superintendent Manning to tell us a little bit about the CTE offerings in his area. So, Ms.
Superintendent Patrick Manning, the Nana City School District, through the chair, just want to share some of the things that we do here that I think are important for our students. We have a great welding program where our students get certifications and prepare to go out into the workforce. We also have a construction program that gives them real life experiences and opportunity to develop those skills. We have a ETT program that we run as well for those that are more interested in the health fields. And then beyond those programs, we also provide other opportunities, as mentioned by Mr. Woodhead, such as we have band and choir, we have dual credit, we have a transition coordinator who works with our students and helps them prepare scholarships, applications for college, and exposes them to different programs that are out there other than just the academic tracks. And then, of course, we have an interventionist that works with our secondary students, those who come to us that need help in their academic skills as well. So those are some of the programs that we have that I'd like to highlight.
Thank you for that. I was wondering if you could comment on, do many of the students apply for the Alaska Performance Scholarships? Do we have the curriculum in place if they would like to try and earn that scholarship?
Yes, we do. And fortunately, in the last few years, we've been able to do more for those students as the Alaska Scholarship expanded into the CTE realm a little bit more. And that was a great boon for those students that have come to us.
Thank you for that. And now I'm going to go to Rep. Eichscheid.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the Co-Chair, thank you both for your invited testimony. And thank you for your service to children. I have the same question for both of you. I'd like to start with Mr. Woodhead. Sir, first of all, thank you for being in Anchorage. I represent Northeast Anchorage, so thank you for being there. And also thank you for noting how you interact with Anchorage School District. King Tech Academy is certainly an ecosystem in education. You know, a lot of different folks working together for the betterment of kids. But since this bill essentially increases funding after approximately 10 years of stagnant funding, what has your enrollment been, first of all, at KCA, and then for Superintendent Manning, maybe statewide, for our residential schools? Has the enrollment trend been declining, stagnant, or increasing? And then the second part of the question is, if you get some increased funding to make up for the flat funding over the last 10 years, do you think your enrollment will increase?
Through the co-chair, so we have a residential max of 70, and so our count period is the Friday of the last Friday of the first quarter. So this year, I believe it was October 18th, and so it's a one-time count. And so the folks that we have on campus that night are the ones that we include in our count. I mentioned that we have three different variable terms that we operate under. So we have semesterly, quarterly, and weekly, and there's ebbs and flows. So we try to target 36 LYSD students per quarter, plus we average about 6 to 7 semesterly students, and then the rest of the students that we're bringing in that gets us closer to 70 are through partnerships that we're doing with other programs. So those other programs include Bristol Bay Region. They provide us the distance aviation instruction, but then when they bring their students into Anchorage, we house those students, our students fold in with them, and then participate in those intensives. We have other weekly intensives that we're offering through the T3 program in University of Alaska Fairbanks. So when they have programming that happens in Anchorage at our T3 hub site, which is KCA, our students fold into that as well. And so we have students coming and going. We've stacked our partnerships really smart. There's consortium models popping up all over the place, it seems like. And for us,
You know, I don't have a welding booth. I don't have an auto body shop. I don't have a culinary program. We go out and we partner for those things. And so what you get at KCA is you have a really robust residential program with driver simulators and flight simulators. We're teaching core content area through Apex Online Learning and other partners that are coming in. But really, the CTE access is all through really strategic and intentional partnerships. Voyage to Excellence is one of our partners. They provide the driver's ed instruction for us. So we've just gone out there and we found the partners to be able to stack and braid these funding sources. It is exhausting. I mentioned the, you know, we're constantly chasing and living and dying by the grant cycles. And having stagnant residential funding has not been helpful in those pursuits. I really appreciate the fact that we're talking about this and looking at it a little bit closer. For us, as Mr. Manning had mentioned, these fundings will help us maintain what we have. And again, we're constantly looking for other resources that are going to help us provide the wraparound services that our students require. We have a robust student health services in partnership with South Central Foundation to do clinics here at KCA. Those types of things have been really important to providing just a well-rounded program that meets all the needs of our students that come in from a pretty remote region. So I hope that answers your question. Again, I'm happy to answer any more about this. But yeah, it's there's a lot of moving pieces with a lot of different funding sources and a lot of different partnerships.
Yeah, through the co-chair.
Bye, Shai.
Mr. Woodhead, that was a fabulous answer, but it wasn't to the question I asked. I just simply wanted to know if your enrollment over the last 10 years at KCA has been declining, stable, or increasing. And what I got out of that is maybe it's been at its max capacity over the last 10 years. So if you can just clarify that.
Yeah.
Questions.
So we've been in existence for 7 years, and what we've claimed on this is a hard one kind of for me to answer. What we've claimed on our rolls was right in the middle of COVID, so those were about half capacity what we were claiming on the rolls, and we opened at half capacity with the blessing of our board during COVID to help us kind of mitigate getting through that. Coming out of COVID, we were closer to 70 every time. So I would say over the long run, because of the pandemic, you know, yeah, we're upwards to where we should be residentially. Yes. And in terms of the amount of applications we're getting and the folks that we're taking in, that's been fairly consistent throughout.
Thank you. And then Superintendent.
Yes, Manning. We will go to Superintendent Manning now. Please introduce yourself.
Superintendent Manning, Nenana City School District, through the co-chair. We have the capacity for 100 students, and during our count period, that's usually right around where we're at is the 95 to 97 number. And so for us, in the last 10 years, that number has been pretty steady. We've had a few years that dipped. I've been superintendent for about 8 years. My second year in, because of the transition in my position, I believe, our numbers were low for some reason that year. But since then, they've been up. And I'm pretty sure that Galena City School District has experienced the same thing. As far as the numbers increasing, we just don't have the capacity to increase our site anymore. I'm not sure whether Galena does, but I do know that there is an interest, just mostly because of the opportunities that we provide that bring students in. We've been able to keep our enrollment up and pretty steady.
Thank you for that response. I have a question. Is the one-day count period effective? Do you feel that that's reflective of what the attendance is? Or do you think it should be a similar 20-day count as done in other schools?
Through the co-chair, if I could just comment on that, I would say that there are year-round boarding schools and there are variable term boarding schools. And for variable term boarding schools, it's, we have ebbs and flows in the amount of students that we have. And obviously, having a single day count period, we are right at quarter transition. And so we have a lot of students in our facility during high peak times. And that is definitely one of those times. So moving the count period to a different time might be reflective that we only have 45 students that night and maybe not 70 at the end of the session, like the end of quarter one in October. So for me personally, the singular count day makes sense because of the variable termness of a lot of these programs. I know that we have in it to request a different day count period for the week-long intensive variable term programs that we have. Obviously, you don't want your count on a planning week when no students are in your building. So those are all things that each program examines and then make sure that they're looking ahead to make sure that the count period is on the appropriate night.
Thank you for that response. Superintendent Manning, do you have a response to that question?
Superintendent Manning at Nenana City School District. My response would be that the one date works for us. We're able to open up our opportunities for students. Some of them maybe have applied for Mount Edgecombe or someplace else. And so by the time they get to the place where they've sorted out where they want to be or where they weren't accepted and then accepted, for us, it's nice to just have one date to say, this is where we're at today. And then, of course, that number adjusts throughout the year based upon homesickness or, you know, whatever else goes on throughout the year. But it at least gives us a chance on that one day to say, okay, we've got a solid group of students here that we can prepare for the year.
Thank you for that response. I had another question, and that question just escaped my mind. So let me pause for a second. Thank you. My question had to do with how your funding mechanisms go between the different school districts, because you say with the one-time funding we did not get any funding. I was a little confused about that. I know that your funding, the home district has, this is my understanding, the home district gets the BSA number and then there's a memorandum of agreement and they pay a certain amount for the services that you're providing. But if you could help me explain that a little bit more, I'd appreciate it. And I'll start with Mr. Manning.
Thank you, Superintendent Manning, Nenana City School District. In response to that, for us, our funding right now, we get the boarding facility funding, and then we also do get the count number for the BSA in our district. Those students become our students for the year, and so we are funded to carry that load with them. As far as what has happened as far as the funding, it was established in FY15, and then a few, not this year, but prior to this year, we've had some one-time funding that has helped us, assisted us in meeting the needs, and hasn't fully met what we expend on these students, but it's offset some of that cost. And that was channeled through different pieces like CTE or different areas like that we receive that funding. And that really helped. But this year, I think just the individual who used to kind of carry that was Senator Quick Bishop. And I just don't know what happened, but for some reason we didn't get that one-time funding this year. And I think for us, it's been a real, real tough year without it. So.
Thank you for that, Mr. Manning. I have Superintendent Manning. Mr. Woodhead, what is your response to that question?
Yeah, not a ton to add on that. We're in the same boat. I would say that while our residential funding serves 70, upwards of 70 students, we serve way more than 70 students within our typical school year. So, and again, variable terms are a little bit of a moving target. That's why the one night count is so important, because if you're going to look at a 10-day or a 10-day count, a lot of our variable term programs are a week-long intensives, filtering multiple students in throughout their quarters. So, yeah, that's what I would say to that.
Follow-up to that question, Mr. Woodhead. I thought I heard you say that you didn't get a BSA increase, and so does that mean you're – so I thought you didn't get a BSA headcount.
Our students are part of the Lower Yukon School District, so for the at least 36 students that are coming in, we do get a BSA rate and a residential rate for those students. For the others outside of our district students that are filtering through our programming, we're counting other school districts in that count for the count period. Much like, let's say Voyage to Excellence, for example, they partner with 4 to 5 different school districts, I believe, to be able to do that. And they each get a base student allocation for their respective districts. And then Voyage to Excellence and Chugach School District gets the nightly rate gets the residential rate for the students that are in their program for that night. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, and it brings up another question for Rep. Elam, and then I'm going to move on to the fiscal note. Rep. Elam.
Thank you. Appreciate the work you guys are doing there in those CTE programs as well. Always something that's kind of near and dear to me. I guess this question might be for you guys, but it is probably more for the sponsor kind of planning. I'm just kind of wondering how we got to the numbers and how do we know what the numbers should be, and if those numbers work for you guys.
Yes, I'll go to Rep. Hemshoot first.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story, through the chair to Representative Elam. Our calculation was just basically taking inflation from 2015 to 2025 and applying that to the previous number.
Okay, so that's like it. If I'm follow.
Yeah, follow up.
Just basic CPI. Yeah.
Correct, which through the chair is based on Anchorage prices, but it is the number that we use.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And I did note that both testifiers recommended that we look at Senate Bill
257.
257, and so perhaps the sponsor, Rep. Hemshoot, can comment on that.
Sure, and I think it's important to go through that fiscal note quickly as well. But Senate Bill 257 ties an increase to the base student allocation, so when the BSA goes up, residential funding would go up. I don't have any disagreement with that. I think it's important to note that the Education Funding Task Force will be looking at residential schools, and so that kind of structural change is something that the task force is looking at and will study and come back with recommendations. So while 257 may be a good solution, we wanted to make sure that we didn't lose track of a basic solution while looking at a solution tied more to policy. And so we wanted to make sure we had both options out there.
Thank you for that. So we're going to go on to Director of Finance and Support Services, Heather Heineken, to share the fiscal note. Thank you, Director Heineken, for being with us today. And then I wanted to thank our invited testifiers today, too. Thank you. That was very helpful. Ms. Heineken.
Good morning, Co-Chair Starry and House Education Committees. For the record, my name is Heather Heineken. I am the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education. And today there is one fiscal note for HB 380 for residential school funding. And this bill increases per student amount for residential program grants under AS 14-16-200B, and it's approximately 26% across the board. currently in the governor's budget, it's $9.307 million for residential school programs. HB 380 would increase the request for FY27 by $2.286 million. And this increase assumes the approval and funding for the Bristol Bay Regional Career and Technical Education Program that is proposed in the FY27 governor's budget. And then the same increase is proposed for the out years FY27 through 32. And this is for OMB component number 148, Residential School Program Fund. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Do I have any questions from the committee? I do not see any questions. Thank you very much for your explanation. And I'm going to return to Rep. Hemshute to give any closing comments, and then we will move on.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. I believe we noticed public testimony.
Public testimony, yes. I should look at my notes, my script here. Sorry about that. Thank you, Ms. Lubin, for responding so quickly to that. So I'm going to open up public testimony on this residential bill. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will go online. Do we have anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Public testimony is closed. We will now set House Bill 380 aside to be taken up at a later date. Our next order of business is House Bill 374, entitled An Act Relating to the Base Student Allocation and Providing for an Effective Date. This bill has been heard twice in this committee, once for introduction and invited testimony, and once for public testimony. We will now bring it back before the committee to discuss the fiscal notes. Representative Hemshute, will you please introduce yourself again for the record and begin?
Thank you, Co-Chair Story, to the committee. I don't have a lot to add. This is a pretty straightforward issue, but we didn't have, I don't think we had a chance to look at the fiscal notes. We wanted to make sure we had that opportunity today.
Thank you, Rep. Hemshute. We have Director Heineken on the line. Would you go over the fiscal notes, please?
Sure. Good morning again, Co-Chair Story and Health Education Committee. Again, for the record, Heather Heineken, Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education. For House Bill 374, there are three fiscal notes. The first fiscal note is the Public Education Fund, which is OMB component number 2804. And this is proposing an increase to the base student allocation by $630 from $6,660 to $7,290. The proposed increase will create a cost of $158,599,000 in FY27, and the cost will be the same for the out years of 28 through 32. And the bill takes effect July 1st, 2026. The second fiscal note is the foundation program. And this is, let me start with its OMB component number 141. This is a $0 fiscal note, and it's a funding mechanism for, it's a general fund transfer from the public, to the public education fund. So, they're not directly deposited into the foundation program, so it's for analysis purposes, for information purposes only. And then the final fiscal note is Mount Edgecombe, and this one is for a interagency receipt between the Public Education Fund and Mount Edgecombe, component number 1060, and that would increase the funding for the component by $453,000. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that, Director Heineken. Do I have any questions from the committee? Seeing no further questions, We will now set an amendment deadline for House Bill 374 as Thursday, March 26th at 5 p.m. Please submit all amendments to my office or the office of Rep. Hemshoot by that time. We will now take a short at ease to return the gavel to Rep. Hemshoot.
We're back on record, and we are going to move forward with our agenda to our final order of business, which is Senate Bill 20, sponsored by Senator Gray Jackson, an act relating to cardiopulmonary resuscitation education in public schools and relating to the duties of the Department of Education and Early Development. I would like to invite Senator Gray Jackson and staff to come forward, introduce yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Senator L.B. Gray Jackson, representing District G in Anchorage. I'm really thrilled and truly honored that my bill is being heard this morning. This legislation has the potential to help our kids learn life-saving measures that will make a difference in communities across the state. Cardiac arrest is the third leading cause of death in the United States, claiming over 365,000 lives each year. When administered immediately, CPR can more than triple a person's chance of survival. This legislation aims to strengthen health education in our schools by equipping students with the knowledge and the skills that they need to respond effectively in emergencies. This year, during a Senate Finance Committee hearing, the senator from Golovin reminded us that CPR has been needed more than once in this very building. In those moments, lives were saved simply because someone nearby had the training and the confidence to act. The American Heart Association recommends this curriculum nationwide as a proven way to introduce hundreds or even thousands of new lifesavers into our communities each year. The program not only teaches practical skills, but it also builds the confidence. Students need to act when every second counts. During a visit with members of the Heart Institute of Anchorage, I saw training videos from rural communities. It was truly inspiring to see these students that were eager to learn these essential techniques. The Heart Institute shared that many students retain these skills for years, ready to use them when they're needed. But most importantly, this bill does not present an unfunded mandate. The course is a one-time class during the student's career, not a semester or year-long requirement, so it won't overburden our magnificent teachers. Furthermore, the bill has very strong support from organizations such as the Anchorage Fire Department, the Heart and Vascular Institute, and the American Heart Association. My goal this morning here is to ensure that students gain life-saving skills while supporting, not burdening, again, our incredible teachers across Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And would you like to, or for your introduction, I guess, of your bill, would you like to present the sectional analysis or summary of changes?
Thank you. Senator Gray Jackson here again. And I'm here with my magnificent intern, Denali, and she'd be more than happy to do the sectional analysis.
Awesome. For the record, Denali Zantop, intern for Senator Gray Jackson. Thank you again, House Education Committee, for hearing this piece of legislation. I will briefly walk through the sectional analysis, as well as some changes to the bill and the key points for Senate Bill 20, CPR curriculum. As for the sectional analysis, Section 1 of the bill removes CPR from the existing health education statute, and Section 2 creates a new standalone CPR education requirement. It directs the department to develop age-appropriate, hands-only CPR curriculum, as well as determine the grade levels the curriculum is taught in and require schools to provide the instruction. The curriculum must follow national evidence-based guidelines, including hands-on practice, and may be delivered by certified CPR instructors, EMS providers, or certified teachers. As for some changes to the bill, as originally introduced, this bill included an effective date of August 25th, 2025. Because the bill did not pass last session, the date was removed in Senate Finance. So now the bill will take effect in either 90 days after enactment or upon the governor's signature. No other changes were made. For some key points for this bill, this legislation expands CPR education and equips more Alaskans to respond to cardiac emergencies. It builds confidence in students and prepares them to act when it matters most. This bill emphasizes hands-on learning, improving retention, and real-world readiness. As previously mentioned, schools have flexibility in who provides the instruction, including teachers, EMS providers, and certified instructors, with support from partners like the Anchorage Fire Department to help identify qualified individuals statewide. Increasing the number of CPR-trained individuals strengthens community emergency response and helps create more lifesavers each year. CPR certification is also a valuable transferable skill, particularly in the healthcare and public safety fields. Thank you.
Thank you for that analysis. Are there questions from the committee before we go to invited testimony? Okay, great. I think we'll go online to our first testifier, which is Chief Shragi of the Anchorage Fire Department. Please introduce yourself on the record and begin your testimony. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. This is Doug Shragi. I'm the fire chief for the Municipality of Anchorage Fire Department. And I would like to thank you and the members of the committee for hearing this bill and to Senator Gray Jackson for bringing it. You've heard about the bill and what it attempts to accomplish. I mainly want to speak about the importance of providing CPR instruction in the school system. As you know, this adds CPR training to an existing health curriculum. It's not new, and uses existing readily available curricula that is available just about everywhere. And it can be taught either by a local EMS provider or a local CPR instructor, which many fire departments are able to provide, particularly in smaller and rural communities. The importance of this bill is that it is key to closing the gap in between engagement of our 911 system and saving people who have experienced sudden cardiac arrest. Every day of every year, someone goes into sudden cardiac arrest, and often the first person providing CPR that has been trained is the EMS provider that arrives in an ambulance or on a fire truck. In the interim, our dispatchers and dispatchers in many communities are able to coach people into performing hands-only CPR over the phone, but this is far less effective than it would be had people been trained. I heard Senator Gray Jackson say that not only that, but being provided this training in the school system provides people with the confidence to take action, which is a hindrance, and it's an impediment to many people engaging. We have mainly relied on workplace requirements and voluntary recruitment of adults to engage in CPR training, and this has been insufficient. We know that most cardiac arrests occur in the home, and believe that a student of any age that has been trained in CPR is likely to be home and can provide life-saving care. There are many examples where a student has provided CPR in the home. This bill is supported by the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I'm a past president of the association and a current member. And the members of this association represent fire departments throughout the state, small and large. And this bill is intended to minimize the impact on the school districts. We do want to be sensitive to the refrain that we want to avoid providing mandates to the school district. This is a This is a life-saving opportunity that I feel very strongly about, and I think the greater good is served by providing CPR instruction to students in the school system. So I'm happy to take any questions, and I'll remain online. Thank you again very much.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions for Chief Shragi? Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Chief Shragi, for your work, commitment to the Anchorage and statewide fire departments. And I'm wondering if you could give me a little history here. When did we go to the hands-only CPR as a best practice? And if you could give me a little rationale for that.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Story. That's an excellent question. The science of cardiac arrest and resuscitation, CPR, supports the idea of hands-only CPR, especially in systems where EMS is close by. So what we have found is that for short periods of time, CPR is more effective if it is provided with continuous chest compressions without the interruptions of stopping to do a rescue ventilation or a mouth-to-mouth breathing. We have learned that the pause that we were traditionally taught to provide mouth-to-mouth breathing actually reduces the effectiveness of the circulation of the patient's blood to their brain and other vital organs. Now, after some period of time, the amount of oxygen that is entrained in the bloodstream is depleted and rescue breaths are appropriate. But for short periods of time, say up to 10 minutes, hands-only CPR is the preferred method. It's also, performing mouth-to-mouth respirations is an activity that many people would view as an impediment to providing care. And so hands-only CPR is being promoted as the solution.
Oh, thank you for that.
Okay. Other questions for Chief Shragi? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. Through the Co-Chair, Chief Shragi, thank you for your service, first of all, keeping Anchorage safe. The question I think I have that I think you kind of said, but I just want clarification. If this bill becomes law, at least from the Anchorage Fire Department's perspective, would you be willing to make EMS personnel available to come into the schools where needed to teach this hands-free or mouth hands-only CPR?
Chief Shragi.
Yes, thank you, Representative Eichheit, through the co-chair. We are currently providing, on a limited basis, CPR instruction to the community, including in the schools, basically on a volunteer basis by some of our providers. I would hesitate to commit the entire fire department to providing CPR instruction to every classroom. But that is something that we could evaluate once we understand what the need is. Given the fact that the CPR instruction is not required on a continuing basis, one time during a student's career in the school system, I think that the commitment would be manageable, but I would be reluctant to commit to that without understanding what the need would be locally.
Other questions for Chief Shragi? I have one. Chief Shragi, what is the survival rate for people who are administered CPR?
Thank you for that question. I didn't hear who asked the question, but
this is
through
Co-Chair,
the chair
or co-chair.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. The survival rate varies, but it's directly correlated to the administration of CPR. We know that survival rate declines about 10% for every minute that CPR is not provided. So the rest depends on the system. If you're in a system such as Anchorage, where we have a 5 to 6 minute response time, sometimes better, sometimes a little bit slower. The survival rate is improved. If you're in a system where the response time might be 10 to 15 minutes, it makes the provision of CPR prior to EMS arrival even more significant. Nationally, the survival rate for sudden cardiac arrest is quite low. I haven't seen the latest recently, but I think it's around 30%. In Anchorage, the survival rate is closer to 50%. The provision of handling the CPR, especially when accompanied by application of an AED or automatic defibrillator, it greatly improves the survival rate.
Thank you for that. We have another question from Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, through the chair, what is your title? Chief Schrage. It says in the bill, the department shall determine which grade levels are required to receive instruction under this section. Do you have a certain age grade level in your mind that you think instruction would be appropriate?
Chief Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. I don't have a specific age in mind. I know that CPR has been successfully taught and utilized by children at all age, at all grade levels in school. I think it's safe to assume that the sooner you provide the training, the more likely it is that, let me say it differently, at the earlier age that you provide the training, the more likely it is that somebody, a student trained in CPR, will have the opportunity to perform CPR on a family member in particular. That's my answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Schrage.
Thank you, Chief Schrage. I see no other questions from the committee, so we'll go to our other invited testifier, Jason Dolph, safety officer with the Anchorage Fire Department. Please put your name on record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Store, Health Education Committee. My name is Jason Dolph. I'm a safety officer with the Anchorage Fire Department. I'm a second-generation firefighter and a 27-year veteran in the emergency services here in Alaska, working both as a professional in Kodiak and now here in Anchorage. I'm a certified emergency medical technician. I'm a EMT instructor as well as a longtime CPR instructor. And here today to talk to you a little bit about Senate Bill 20. I want to first start by painting a little bit of a picture. My very first day as a firefighter, the very first call I ever responded to about 2 minutes into my career was a cardiac arrest, a sudden stop of heart function. And I'll never forget the scene. It's imprinted in my mind because as I walked through the door, there was a man laying on the couch. He was gray in color. And around him was about 8 family members. And none were performing CPR or attempting any other life-saving measures. And you know, you have to ask yourself, why? Why would a family member not be willing to or to help or engaged? And it was simply because they didn't know what to do. No one had ever trained them in CPR. They never had the opportunity. It wasn't required for their work or in any other capacity throughout their life. During my career, I've responded to more than 10,000 emergency calls and incidents. And in that time, I've made this observation. When responders arrive and no bystander is performing CPR, we most often have negative results despite our best efforts and despite advancements in medicine. On the other hand, when CPR is being performed by a bystander on our arrival, we often have very positive results. And that is simply because for every minute a cardiac arrest patient goes without CPR, chances of survival, as Chief Schrage said, drop exponentially by about 10%. CPR, even hand-only CPR, can double and most often triple the survival rate, and the earlier the better. What we say in our business is that time, the faster we can get our hands on the chest, time equals heart muscle. There's over 350,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests each year in the United States. While immediate CPR is critical to survival, only about 40% of people who suffer sudden cardiac arrest actually receive CPR before professionals arrive. Many people aren't trained. People simply don't know what to do, like my very first call, or people are not comfortable engaging in patient care. In order to save lives, it's imperative that everyday citizens learn and perform immediate hands-only CPR until help arrives. And so the question always, in every community with every emergency response system, comes up, how do we engage the community to learn CPR? Senate Bill 20 aims to start CPR education early. Children as young as 9 to 10 years old can acquire the knowledge and perform the skills of CPR. It's been shown that even children as young as 4 are able to learn at least some role in CPR and the continuum of survivability. CPR in schools gives an opportunity, an environment, and a means to provide life-saving training where we can avoid busy adult schedules and high demands. It normalizes CPR. Subjects learn in school become comfortable in second nature. Students learn confidence and gain reinforcement from participation with peers. And our end goal is to create a generation of lifesavers, citizens who were taught very early the importance of CPR and the critical steps and skills to perform CPR. It aims to create a culture of cardiac awareness, a lifelong commitment to life-saving skills, and ultimately change the narrative that we see every single day with the cardiac arrest problem. Once it's started and we built a foundation, we believe it will perpetuate itself indefinitely. Now, you guys already have heard that over 40 states have already addressed the cardiac arrest problem and CPR by passing legislation requiring the introduction of CPR in the schools. And as a state, our EMS system has always been on the leading edge of innovation and growth. We are so very fortunate that in Alaska, a curriculum has already been developed and is ready to go. Stakeholders and emergency responders are poised to assist with the implementation of CPR in the schools at a local level. And as such, as you heard, there's no fiscal note or financial burden associated. In closing, my wife is an elementary educator. She's been in elementary classrooms for over 25 years. My daughter is a senior in high school, and I myself am even a substitute teacher. I've been substitute teaching with the Anchorage School District for over 20 years. I have a very high regard for education and our education system in Alaska. All of the subjects we learn are important: reading, writing, math, history, art, all of it. They create a well-rounded individual, and they are important to the growth and development of us individually as humans. The saying goes that knowledge is power. I ask you this: if someone is in cardiac arrest, the only knowledge powerful enough to save them is the knowledge of CPR. What can be more important? No amount of reading, writing, math, history, foreign language, art, economics, you name it, is going to save that person. And is there anything more powerful than that? I certainly also understand the demands of our students and educators. I hear it firsthand. I've seen it firsthand. Hands-only CPR is easy to learn for both students and educators. Curriculum and resources are abundantly available through the state of Alaska EMS. It only takes an hour, and best of all, it costs nothing. Representative Dibert and Eichheit, I had the pleasure of meeting you at Fire Ops 101 in 2024, where you worked side-by-side with Anchorage firefighters to play a role in emergency response, and you spent an hour with us learning and delivering CPR, and so you can attest to how simple it actually can be. I thank you for the opportunity to allow me to testify. I'm really excited to have this Senate bill in front of you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? I have one. Oh, Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshoot. Mr. Dahl, thank you for your service. Thank you for the excellent instruction of Fire Ops 101. Everyone should do that. Sir, my question refers to your first story where your first call was a cardiac arrest and you arrived and there were 8 family members standing around the victim, but not performing any life-saving service because of a lack of training. And I suspect you've encountered that multiple times. So the question I have is, and it's a bit of conjecture on your part, but what kind of trauma is created for somebody who wants to help, who loves somebody, but doesn't because they simply don't have the training? What kind of trauma does that produce for family members?
Officer Dolph?
Yeah, thank you for the question. You're 100% right. Throughout my career, I've seen this play out many, many times. And I can say that just judging by families' reactions, death and dying is obviously never an easy process for people, especially when it's sudden and it involves sudden cardiac arrest. And throughout my career, I have literally heard family members questioning themselves and saying, why didn't I, or I was doing it wrong, or especially after watching us perform CPR. And so it's very obviously traumatic, but it's even been traumatic for me as a first responder when I show up and I see the, what could have been, or, knowing what I know about survivability and then watching their reaction, it creates trauma for first responders, not just the family members, but first responders. And so, again, I've seen it play out where people are very emotionally distraught. We've even talked to, people after the fact. They will often come to fire stations and they will, come by to say thank you. And there's a lot of self-doubt and a lot of second-guessing, and it's our job to make sure that we, encourage and, to try to lift them up. But it is very damaging, and it's very difficult for someone to not be able to do anything. I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up? Just a brief comment, sir. I just, I'm a former educator. In 2009, I had after school, one of our students had a cardiac arrest, one of our cross-country athletes, in the gymnasium. I was not present there. I was outside. But one of my teacher colleagues was there. And even though there was an AED located nearby, even though there were students and my teacher colleague, no life-saving efforts were conducted. EMS responded very quickly, and happily that eighth grader is now 25 years old, pursuing a dental career. But I do know my teacher colleague, who I was very close with, it was a trauma to her, because teachers care about their students, and I've never forgotten that. So I think it's important that people realize that if knowledge is power, if you don't have the knowledge, it creates a trauma. Thank you.
Thanks for that insight. Okay, Co-Chair Story, or I guess Representative Dybert first, and then Co-Chair Story.
Thank you. Good morning. Through the co-chair to Mr. Dahl, thank you for your presentation and your words. And I truly enjoyed Fire Ops 101, and just super appreciate that training that you provided for community leaders. And I do recommend all of us here as state leaders to take that training. And I remember when I was in the training, even though it was just once, I remember where to place my hands and and I think there was a song that was a perfect
Staying Alive.
Got it. That's just so I'm just telling folks, pull that song up on your phone, and that's the beat. I just remember that, and it's so important that we do have this training in our schools. I had a colleague of mine who taught first grade who had a cardiac arrest, and in the classroom, and luckily it was in the morning. There's hustle and bustle in the school, and one of the first grade students ran to the office. and was able to find someone who had training and was able to come help my colleague survive. And she's doing well to this day, so because of that. If students are trained, do they get do they carry a certificate around for their wallet, or what's their honor? You know, what are they honored with after the training? Thanks.
Safety Officer Dolph, can you talk about, is there a card that people carry when they're CPR certified?
Yes, thank you, Representative Dybert, to the co-chair. The CPR in the Schools program is intended to be a hands-only program that is a non-certification program. And there's a lot of layers to the reason it's a non-certification program. One is that, it's a limited amount of time that is spent. So with certification comes some testing and usually adds some more layers of beyond the hands-only portion. Our goal is that by introducing the students to the hands-only portion, that again, by creating a generation of lifesavers, that it will encourage students, whether it's, while they're still students or later in life, to take an actual certification course where they can get carded. But I'll be honest, I've been a teacher, a CPR instructor. I've had my own business since 2004, so over 22 years. And, unless you need a card to present for a job or for some other requirement, the education is virtually the same. And so, in short, there is no card or certification that comes from it. That doesn't mean that the schools could not, they could present a certificate saying that they completed it. Obviously, if it's part of the curriculum, it will be known that in order to graduate, they have completed the CPR portion. But again, it doesn't come through the American Heart Association or the American Red Cross or one of the other companies as a certified course. And that also allows us the opportunity to have classroom teachers, health teachers, school nurses, those that are not certified as instructors, teach the curriculum as well. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you for giving us that overview.
We'll go now to Co-Chair Story.
Thank you. My question had to do with something that Rep. Eichheit brought up when he was talking about the trauma families experienced or loved one experienced when they witnessed a death or just went through an experience and hopefully the person survived. But who does the fire department, are you mandated to give a referral to a support agency, a counseling agency? How do you help in that department?
Officer Dolph?
Debrief on the couch. Yeah, thank you for the question. At the Anchorage Fire Department, we have a lot of resources available, and I imagine many of the communities do as well. We are very fortunate in Anchorage that we have the Alaska Police and Fire Chaplains. We have basically a 24/7 chaplain on duty, and we, whether it's first responders as fire and EMS, or first responders as police officers, or even our dispatch. We can all make referrals to bring in a chaplain, to the scene or connect the victims of a crisis with the chaplains by whatever means is necessary. We are trained as first responders to make sure that we are not just leaving the scene without making sure that we have taken care of the people, the survivors, the family members, those that might be traumatized. Whether that's we stay on scene, we connect them with their own family group, their own pastor or chaplain, some kind of support network, or again, our police and fire chaplains. And, coming from Kodiak, where we didn't have police and fire chaplains, it was much of the same. As long as we had made some connection before we left, i.e., we connected them with a community a group or a family member or whatever their support network was, we made sure that we saw that continuum covered and make sure that they have someone or a resource that they could go to.
Thank you for that.
Okay, and then I just have one quick final question. I understand that this is not an unfunded mandate, and so it says the department shall adopt curricula, curricula exist. My question, I think, goes to Safety Officer Dolph. How do you see this working in rural or even more importantly, remote Alaska? It's not a requirement, so they don't have to do it, but do you have a vision for how this could work in rural and remote schools?
Yeah, thank you for the question. In rural Alaska, we're very fortunate. I just spoke with the new fire chief of on Alaska, and Edward Athey is the new fire chief out there starting next week, and he, you know, told me out in Alaska, rural Alaska, he is 100% on board. And I think the way I see this working in rural Alaska is engaging their first responder network, whether it's the public health aides, the fire departments, the law enforcement agencies, and even the teachers, providing the curriculum, even if they're not instructors, the curriculum can easily be learned by an educator and then delivered to the students. It can also be delivered without equipment. A lot of people say, do we need mannequins and, you know, all of this expensive equipment? You don't necessarily need mannequins and equipment. I've taught CPR classes with pillows and cushions before. You know, we use the resources that we have. I often think to, as a substitute teacher, about any subject that's in school, when I come in as a substitute teacher, I can fondly remember getting a subject for health that I was teaching, and it was on, of all subjects, bloodsuckers. That was the name of the title, and it was all about fleas, ticks, leeches, and animals that lived on blood. And I don't know much about any of those things. And how did I learn it? I read the material, I prepared myself, and I was able to present it. And so I think, you know, SANS having, you know, emergency responders that are available to teach it, an educator in any of those scenarios or any of those areas could easily, you know, go through the state, get the curriculum, and have the support of the state of Alaska EMS, and they would be able to deliver it seamlessly. I don't think there would be any problems at all. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, certainly. And it reminds me, I worked on a remote island in the Pacific, and we were working with endangered seals, and we actually used couch cushions and pillows to practice. I can't even describe it, but the compressions on a seal look way different than on a human. So, okay. Any last questions from the committee? I feel like we've kind of gone as far as we're going to go on this one for today. So thank you so much for your testimony, Chief Schrage and Safety Officer Dolph, and for being here today, Senator Gray Jackson and Staff Denali.
Zantop.
Thank you for that. Okay. That is going to conclude our meeting for today. Our next meeting will be this Wednesday, March 25th. Oh, apologies. I forgot to say we're going to set the bill aside. We're going to set Senate Bill 20 aside. I didn't read my script.
Madam Chair, before you end the meeting, can I make
a
comment?
Of course.
Thank
apologies,
you. I appreciate
of course,
it.
Senator.
No worries. But I also took Fire Ops 101, and I would encourage you who haven't to do it. But, you know, for me, bringing forward legislation that benefits our communities throughout the state as a whole touches my heart. No pun intended. I'm thrilled that you heard the bill this morning. I look forward to being heard again. And I also look forward, I'm going to focus on this bill, making it to the finish line before the end of this session. Thank you again for hearing my bill.
Thanks for your time this morning and for presenting. So, yes, we are going to set Senate Bill 20 aside to be taken up at a later date. And that is going to conclude our meeting for today. Our next meeting is this Wednesday, March 25th at 8 a.m. in this room, Davis 106. We will hear from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the Department of Education and Early Development, and the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. This hearing will focus on career and technical education and will include an overview of Carl Perkins funds, the Career Guide Program, and other CTE initiatives. After that, we will hear House Bill 358, sponsored by Representative Elam. And as a reminder, the committee's email address is house.education@akleg.gov. Public testimony can be sent to this address. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 9:53 a.m.